Greetings. Welcome to the Dr. Meg Show, conscious talk for greater reality. We are on the World Pooja Network, and boy, am I glad you're here. Want to remind you that my new book, The Children of Now, is now available at bookstores everywhere. If you'd like to know more about it or more about me, feel free to go to my website at www.spiritlite.com. That's www.spiritlite.com. And while you're there, feel free to register for the free online messages that I send out every month. There's no obligation, and you can stop anytime you want and get a free MP3 while you're there. Also, feel free to visit my web store. I've taken a lot of time and care picking out products and books and CDs that are really good tools for enhancing our experience here on this earth and in our journey. So, thanks for being here. And we'll be right back right after a few messages from our wonderful sponsors. Thanks a lot. Many children struggle with learning, unable to focus in the classroom, and are often misdiagnosed with ADHD. All too often, a child's struggle to learn is a result of auditory processing or sensory integration disorder. These disorders can keep your child's intelligence from being recognized, leaving them characterized by behavioral problems, resulting in low self-esteem. Speech and motion can help without the use of drugs. Visit speechandmotion.com today and get your child on the road to success. That's speechandmotion.com.
It is with glorious celebration that Lisa Whatley introduces, with the objective of helping to create heaven on earth, the simple and powerful high-frequency healing energy known as La Ho Chi. La Ho Chi healing energy is infinite in its abilities, expanding our energy field, activating our light body, accelerating our healing and spiritual gifts, reweaving the energy field, performing acupuncture in the etheric field, and so much more. Schedule your session today. First-time clients receive 25% off their first session. Visit infinitylighthealing.com for more information or email Lisa at infinitylighthealing.com.
Medicine Woman, the stunning first book of internationally acclaimed author and mystic Lynn Andrews. Now, a quarter of a century later, Lynn celebrates a whole new generation of readers with the 25th anniversary edition of this landmark publication. This book honors and celebrates the power of shamanism and the wisdom of Native American women around the world. In this just-released anniversary edition of Medicine Woman, Lynn adds for the very first time additional details of her apprenticeship with Medicine Woman Agnes Whistling Elk, and she shares new insights into her experiences in the Canadian wilderness. Share Lynn Andrews' Medicine Woman and the power of the universe today. Available at Amazon.com and other fine booksellers everywhere.
And we're back live on the World Pooja Network. This is the Dr. Meg Show, Conscious Talk for Greater Reality. And we have one very special guest with us tonight, but I'm going to keep you in suspense for just a minute. You know, I've been talking for weeks about this alignment, this harmonic alignment that's been going on, the Trinity effect that's been going through the different dimensions over the past few days. It culminated a little after 9 o'clock this morning, and I'll bet a lot of you out there are experiencing some very weird things. A lot of people didn't sleep last night. I know I didn't. And, you know, things are opening up. Everything we've been manifesting is just coming out gangbusters. And all I can say is hold on to your hat. There's no seatbelt. There's no shoulder strap. This is going to be one wild ride and a good one. So, as always, don't resist these energies. Because what happened this morning is we had an alignment of our earthly, our mental, and our source selves. And because of that, we're in a whole different space. We have the opportunities to expand our consciousness awareness like we never have before in the history of humanity. And I know that our guest is going to tell us a lot about why that is tonight, and I can't wait to talk to him. So rather than keep you in suspense with the energy report, you can read all about it on my website at www.spiritlight.com, and just go down to the bottom of the homepage and click on online messages, and it'll take you right to this morning's newsletter. And if you want to join that, just remember it's free. Just there's a link on the website homepage at spiritlight.com, and just sign up, and you'll get these as they come out. Boy, you know, we live our lives based on what we believe about our world, ourselves, our capabilities, and our limits. More often than not, those beliefs come from what science, religion, history, and other people tell us. What if they're wrong? New discoveries reveal that we're not limited by the laws of science as we know those laws today. What we once believed is really about to change. Our guest tonight is... I'm so excited to have on. He's a New York Times best-selling author. He's internationally renowned as a pioneer in bridging science and spirituality. His ability to find innovative solutions to complex problems led to successful careers as a computer geologist for Phillips Petroleum during the 1970s energy crisis, and in the 1980s as a senior computer systems designer for Martin Marietta Aerospace during the last years of the Cold War. In 1991, he became the first technical operations manager for the network innovator Cisco Systems, where he led the development of global support team that assures the reliability of today's Internet. Global crisis of the late 20th century inspired him to leave the corporations and begin a full-time quest for the solutions that he believes survive in the oldest records of our past. For more than 20 years, Greg Braden has searched high mountain villages, remote monasteries, and forgotten texts to uncover their timeless secrets. To date, his work has led to such paradigm-shattering books as The Isaiah Effect, The God Code, and his newest, The Divine Matrix, Bridging Time, Space, Miracles, and Belief. Greg's work shows us beyond any reasonable doubt that we have the power to reverse disease, redefine aging, and even change reality itself by recognizing that we are part of our world rather than separate from it. Now published in 11 languages and 23 countries, his powerful blend of science and spirituality awakens the best in each of us, inspiring our deepest passions to create a better world. For more information, you can go to Greg's website at www.gregbraden.com, but right now he's ours, live and in person. Greg, welcome.
Well, good evening, Dr. Meg. It is a joy. I'm just thrilled to be on the program. This is Valentine's Day. I'm thrilled to be on the program with our listeners on Valentine's Day tonight.
Well, happy Valentine's Day. I know there's a lot of girls out there that would love to be telling you that themselves.
Happy Valentine's Day to everyone. I'm talking to you from a very icy, snow-packed, beautiful evening in the high desert here in northern New Mexico, and I think you're somewhere south of me is what you just said.
Not very far.
Yeah.
Not very far. Well, the great news is that your new book, The Divine Matrix, just hit the New York Times best-selling list last week.
Last week, we're absolutely just very honored and absolutely thrilled because, as you and I spoke briefly before the program, what it tells me, Dr. Meg, is that this kind of information that we'll be speaking about tonight, it's now reached beyond our traditional grassroots support systems. People have always read and supported our books, and I'm very grateful to them for doing so. The whole idea with this book was to find a language to bridge some very, very powerful new discoveries that are very technical in nature, that a lot of people just simply haven't heard about because they sound so technical,
mm-hmm.
to bridge those with what's happening in our lives and our world today in a relevant way, and the fact that so many people now are drawn to this book tells me that that we've begun to understand what that language is all about and reach beyond that traditional base.
Well, you know, it's time, Greg. So many people have been reaching out and more every day, and there's an emptiness that people have been feeling, and they want to know why, and they want to know what more there is, and I know that the Divine Matrix explains that. What is the Divine Matrix?
Well, it's a story of a field of energy that Western science now is only acknowledged within the last few years, Dr. Meg. So it's so fascinating to me that modern science is only about 400 years old, is just arriving at the point where our most cherished ancient and spiritual traditions have always begun. And that is with this understanding that we are bathed in this field of intelligent energy in ways that we're only beginning to understand. So scientists now say, okay, you know, we're convinced the experiments are showing that this field is out there. What do we do with it? And what does it mean in our lives? And this is where it's so interesting to me and why, to me, it's so valuable to spend the time going into some of the most remote, isolated, pristine places left on the earth today, repositories of knowledge and wisdom and practice where our ancestors have understood that this field exists and taken us one step further. Not only do they say, yeah, everything's connected, they say this is how you use that connection in your lives. So to me, this is the blending of science and spirituality, science telling us that the field's there and how it works, and the ancients saying this is how you can apply it for healing, peace, abundance, relationships, career, success, all those kinds of things.
And I can't tell you how excited I personally am that you've brought this forward, because my experience is the opposite end. It's not the scientific end, it's the meta-science. You know, I've had experiences, and I think that a real wake-up call for me was when I read in the Nag Hammadi Gospels, the Gospel of Truth.
Mm.
And the author of that, I can't remember who, I don't think they know who wrote it.
I'm not sure who wrote that, but the entire Nag Hammadi library is a very powerful statement of our power in the universe.
Yeah, and there was the Gospel of Truth, thousands of years old, describing experiences that I was having in my living room and no reference for. And it was absolutely phenomenal for me. So what role does, you know, I love that this is all coming together. But that was my point. There's a role here that the divine matrix plays in our lives, in our universe.
Sure.
Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I think for some people, at first blush, they say, well, I've heard this before, because we've all heard that we're connected.
Mm-hmm.
Living here in the Southwest, it's certainly part of the Native and the Indigenous traditions.
Sure.
That all is one, everything is connected. We've heard that. And what I've found is that some people have heard it for so long, and it has held such little meaning in their lives that they are almost calloused to what this connection may actually mean.
Or it's an idealistic idea with no connection.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Because they say, well, if we're really connected, then, and then there's the litany of questions. Why do these things happen? Why can't we intervene in these things? What the science is telling us, and I document all the, we'll go over this at a high level, or we can go as deep as we'd like in our time tonight. But all the references and all the technical things are documented in the book for people that like to explore those kinds of references on their own. But the scientists are telling us, and what the ancients described in the language of their time, is this field of energy. First of all, it's so new that scientists have yet to agree on a single name. So some people are calling this simply the field. A woman named Lynn McTaggart wrote a beautiful book entitled The Field a few years ago. Stephen Hawking calls it the mind of God. Dr. Edgar Mitchell calls it nature's mind. Some people now are calling it the divine matrix, and that's the term, and we'll talk about why we chose that term in the book. But scientists, they acknowledge this field is there, but it does more than just connect us. It is the container for the entire universe. It's the stuff that holds everything together. There is nothing, the scientists believe, that occurs outside. There is no outside to this
field.
There is
no outside, right.
This field is the stuff of creation. So it's the container for the universe, number one. Number two, it is the bridge between our inner and our outer worlds, between our prayers and feelings and beliefs that we have inside of our bodies, and the physical and non-physical world beyond our bodies. And it's this bridge, this conduit of the divine matrix that allows us to have an effect in our world that extends beyond our bodies. And when we create the right language in our hearts, this field carries that language into the world beyond our hearts, into the bodies of our loved ones for miraculous, seemingly miraculous healings. Or
mm-hmm.
When many people get together using this field for peace in our world. So it is a container, number one. Number two, it's a bridge or a conduit. And number three, it is also a mirror. This divine matrix, this living, pulsating field of energy, is like the projector screen of reality all around us. In my living room, the wall directly across from me, or the rocks and the trees outside my window, they're all happening as a function of this divine matrix. And one of the things that scientists have found, and what the ancients talked about, is that when we can create the right conditions inside of our bodies intentionally, that this field will mirror those conditions back to us in terms of healing and peace and abundance and relationships. And when we create those experiences unconsciously, so we're not aware of what it is that we're actually saying to the field, it will still mirror those things back to us in ways that look mysterious. So we may find ourselves surrounded by angry people, or by lack in our finances, or lack in our nurturing, or the success of our careers. As different as they sound, they're all related through this field. So the field is fulfilling three roles: container, bridge, and mirror. And all of those lead us into a very empowering understanding of our role in the universe. If we choose, we're much more than passive observers. We now are active co-creators. And if we were ever going to embrace that kind of power, I think the conditions of our lives and our world today, this is a really good time to understand what that power really means.
This is such truth. I'm so excited to be talking with you about this that you have no idea. But
let's have a radio program. We'll talk about it.
Let's do it. You know, I've seen this. I'm gifted to see these things. And I've seen this, and my first book, Pyramids of Light, I talked about this different terminology, similar construct. Mm-hmm. But I could only do it from a metaphysical perspective. And what you've done is you found the science that proves it. And that's why I'm so excited.
Well, I'm excited to hear that. You know, it's interesting to me because science is only a language.
Right.
And it is only one language that we may use to describe our world and the way it works. And it's a language that's relatively young. Science is only about 400 years old.
Right.
There are other languages that have been around much longer. Some of them, in the case of the Vedas, about 7,000 years, or the Hebraic traditions, 5,000 years. They describe our universe and who we are, where we come from, and our role in the divine matrix in another language. It's not technical, it's not scientific, and it's very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So where we find ourselves today in the Western world is we've come to rely on science, and as a scientist, I saw this happen in the corporations. We've come to rely upon science as the language that we trust. And unless we can prove something through that language, we tend to either discount it or be very suspicious.
Yeah.
It's telling us, but if you go to other parts of the world, that's not the case.
That's
so
right.
I can go into a monastery in the highlands of central China in Tibet and talk to an abbot or a monk or a nun through the translator about what we're speaking about right now. They don't need to know the proof, and they don't need to know about. They giggle when we tell them about the experiments. They think it's funny.
Sure.
They say sure.
It's of course because it is.
It is. And so for us to honor the way that we in the West, and I'm assuming when I wrote the book that was primarily who I was writing to.
Sure.
To honor the way we learned, I've done my very best to honor the science accurately, although at a high level, and there are technical details in the appendices for people that want them, and to blend that with case histories and true life accounts that really make the science relevant in our lives. And I think that's, I know for me, I learn better through example than I do reading, a bunch of numbers in a book.
No kidding. Well, how do we know the divine matrix exists, other than some of us that can see it and experience it and work within that construct? You know, everyday people that haven't found that level of consciousness yet, how can they know it exists?
Well, we have anecdotal experiences all the time, and I know I'm sure all of our listeners at some point or another they've gone to pick up the telephone to call a friend or a loved one, and found that they picked up the phone and they didn't have to dial because that person was already on the other end of the line.
Sure.
When that happens, obviously there's a communication occurring between those two people. They might be half a world away, or they might be half a country away. And the question is, what is the conduit? What's the stuff that communication is occurring through? Anecdotally, we know that these kinds of things exist. What scientists have done is to be able to, it's just been within the last years of the 20th and now the early years of the 21st century, they've been able to validate this field under laboratory conditions. One of the reasons it's been so hard to find, Dr. Meg, is because this field of energy, it's what's called a non-conventional field of energy. It doesn't work like electricity or like radio broadcast waves or something like that.
Well, and basically, doesn't it defy the laws of physics, I mean, as we know them?
Well, what it tells us is that our laws are not absolute laws. That they're relative. Our laws may apply to some forms of matter under some conditions, but they are not absolute laws for all forms of matter under all conditions. What we know is that you and I and our listeners, we all have the power, and this is where we're going with the conversation tonight. The reason this divine matrix and our relationship to it is important is because not only does the field exist, and not only is it a bridge and a mirror and a container, but there's a language that we were born with that allows us to speak to this field in a way that the field recognizes. So when we use that language, the field will conform to what it is that we have spoken. If we're speaking healing in our bodies, or peace at the family dinner table, or peace between nations, abundance in our lives, or nurturing relationships, if we know the language to communicate that to this field, the divine matrix, then the field conforms, it mirrors that back to us. And this is the great secret of our most cherished spiritual traditions, even the Christian traditions before the books were edited in the 4th century,
right,
spoke about our power to communicate with this field. So the language that we're born with, it's a nonverbal language. It's not about words, and it has no outward expressions. It is simply the power of what we would call belief and human emotion, the feelings we have about what we believe to be true. So when we create very clearly the feeling in our hearts as if our healing has already happened or the peace has already occurred, not think the thoughts, when we learn to really get in touch with the power of the language of feeling in our hearts, this is the language that this field recognizes, and it's what it mirrors back to us in ways that we're only beginning to understand. Scientists found it as early as 1909 in the laboratory. They saw this happening, and they didn't understand why.
Well, it's kind of like the unified field theory, isn't it? I mean, my information is that the unified, and I'm going to really simplify this, at least for your terms, for the listeners, but the unified field theory is basically that there's a weak force and a strong force, and that the information that I have is that the strong force is what, for lack of better vocabulary, I call the particulates. Mm-hmm. And the particulates arrange based on geometric formations and their electromagnetic charges. And then there are corridors between them, which are where the weak charges, what our prayers are, our energy, that heart stuff that we send out, that communicates. And as it does, all of that, all those particulates, all of that matter rearranges to create a new reality.
You can look at it that way. I mean, if we're going to have this on archives and people are going to take notes, I want to be really, really clear and accurate that scientists recognize four fundamental forces of nature.
Okay.
That they're trying to reconcile into one story that tells us how the universe works. The attempt to do that is what is called the unified field theory. And so far, they have been unable to do that. Those four forces, you name two of them. It's the strong and the weak.
Mm-hmm.
Force, the electromagnetic force is another one, and the force of gravity is the fourth one. And the problem has always been that they can't reconcile gravity with the other forces. And there's a whole story about why that may be. But what's important here, from my perspective and what we're talking about, one of the reasons that they have not been able to unify, and they probably will not be able to unify them in the world that we call our three-dimensional world.
No.
Because this is a world of polarity, and things are separate. That's why we have pluses and minuses, and boys and girls, and mm-hmm. light and dark, and good and bad, and right and wrong, and forces that don't necessarily unify. But what they're finding, Dr. Meg, and this is fascinating to me, because it for people that like to understand why they have an effect in the world around them, to me, this begins to open the door to that conversation. What the new theories are showing is that we live in a universe of many dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 25 years ago, if you talked about many dimensions in the language of, you know, in a physics classroom, they'd laugh you right out the door.
Yeah.
And now, many dimensions are required. The new string theories, for example, super string theories, say there have to be at least 11 and probably 25 dimensions that exist for the universe to be the way it is. The reason that's important is because they found that as you go higher in the dimensions, the mathematics that describes them becomes simpler and simpler
mm-hmm.
and simpler, and the difference between the forces becomes less and less and less. And when you get in those higher dimensions, things are unified. And this is important because what the experiments have shown is that human emotion and human feeling are a force that talk to that higher dimension where everything is already unified.
How are they measuring that?
What they do is they design experiments. Again, I talk about these in the books in a number of different ways, but they design experiments based on predictions of what would happen if these things were true. And they know that this field of energy is what's called a non-conventional field of energy. Now that they know that, they're actually able to build the electronics that can measure this field in
ways.
Oh,
they are actually able to. I'm sorry, they are able to measure it now. I wasn't aware of that.
They're able to measure it now in ways that that they were not able to measure it in the past.
Well, that's very exciting.
So the bottom line of what the experiments are showing, there's one set of experiments that show that human DNA, for example, has a direct effect on the stuff that our world is made of. That when they isolate little quantum particles
mm-hmm.
In a vacuum, and they're completely random particles, and they put some human DNA in there, all of a sudden those particles aren't random. They actually align themselves. The DNA is having a direct effect on the stuff our world is made of, and that's one experiment. Another series of experiments are showing that when we change the way we feel in our bodies, we're actually changing the DNA that's having an effect on the stuff our world is made of. And other experiments are showing whether it's in the same room of a laboratory or if it's a half a nation away. One of the experiments was done between Los Angeles and Phoenix, Arizona, or if it's mm-hmm. half a world away, that distance is of no consequence. It doesn't make any difference because the level of energy we're talking about, time and space don't mean the same thing at all.
No, they don't.
So when you put these all together, they're interesting, isolated experiments. A lot of the researchers aren't aware of what other researchers are doing.
Sure.
So they say, well, that was interesting. You know, we'll come back and study it. When you put them all together, however, they begin to tell a story.
Makes one heck of a picture, doesn't it?
It does. And the it's our story. It's the story of us. When we, and this is what the ancients and the great masters have said in our past. They didn't know about the divine matrix and quantum holograms and quantum theory. They didn't have to. They said if you feel this way in your body, you're going to change your body, and when you change your body, you'll change the world.
Mm-hmm.
And what the science is showing is that when we feel what's called coherent emotion in our hearts, we literally change the shape and the way that the DNA absorbs and reflects light. There's a whole conversation we could have about that. But the bottom line is, when we change the way we feel, we're changing the stuff we're made of. And when we change the stuff we're made of, it is having a direct effect on the stuff our world is made of. So when you take out the middle experiment, it says when we feel a certain way, we're having an effect on our world. And we've got beautiful documentation. I show live documentation in our live programs, videos of physical healings that are happening in 2 or 3 minutes, real time,
mm-hmm.
cancerous tumors disappearing from inside the body of a living woman. We can ultrasound her body, and we can see this tumor disappear in less than 3 minutes. in the presence of practitioners who understand these principles. All they're doing is feeling the right feeling, mm-hmm. and her physical body, the matter of her physical body, is responding to it. If we don't understand that, it's a miracle. And if we do understand it, it's a technology, and that's what this technology is all about.
This is something that I understand very well. I've been doing this for years, and I'm just so excited that we're able to say, see, this really does work. And, I mean, to people that don't believe in it and they're afraid of it, you know, it's such a real phenomenon. It's just that when we are who we can do anything.
Well, and we can, and for some people that's a frightening prospect.
Yeah, I know.
And we now find I'm a guy that looks at the big picture. So here we are at the beginning of the 21st century. We're in the time of the greatest nuclear proliferation since the Cold War. When I was working in the industry, we're looking at viruses coming from the other side of the planet that we don't have any antidotes or any vaccines for. We're looking at the very real possibility of abrupt climate change. And we're all saying, you know, what do we do? Why is this happening to us? And what these technologies are saying is that it's not about control or manipulation, and it's not about imposing our will on the world. And I talk about this in the book. It's about us recognizing we are part of, rather than separate from, the world around us, and by virtue of that, we may participate. And that's the word that I use in the book. We can participate. Dr. John Wheeler, a colleague of Albert Einstein's from Princeton University, this is his word. He says, we live in a participatory universe. It's impossible for us to be casual bystanders and believe that we have nothing to do with the disease or the healing of our bodies or the peace or the war in our world. Because we're part of all that we see and all that we experience. So
nothing ever happens to us. It happens of us.
Precisely. And I'm not saying that all these things we're doing consciously.
Right, right.
Many of them we're doing unconsciously. But the key is, if we were ever going to become conscious, take the training wheels off of this school of consciousness and begin to apply what we know, now might be a really good time, because we're faced with conditions for the first time in recorded human history. We're faced with conditions that could literally end the human race as we know it today.
Sure. So but we can change that.
We can, and that's why the frightening predictions and prophecies are possibilities only. None of them need come to pass, and we have the opportunity to change those. We must embrace the power that we have, and not every human on the face of the earth has to believe the same thing to embrace that power. Relatively few number of people with the focused power of what's called coherent emotion outweighs or transcends the chaotic beliefs and the fear of hundreds of millions of people that don't have that focus.
Do you find that when people come together like that because it's proven, I know, that those kind of things really work, that they can measure the vibration somehow. But do you find that people get too specific when they come together? I mean, my sense is that if we came together and just expanded our hearts, that we could communicate more that way universally and throughout our world than if we all tried to get together with a specific intention for a specific cause. Because when we put those intentions out there, everybody's got a different frame of reference, and everybody's got a different expectation for what that's going to look like.
I'm going to answer that with a yes and a no.
Okay.
And then let me give an example. It depends on this. We're talking about a technology, Dr. Meg. It's an internal technology.
Mm-hmm.
A growing number of, I'll just preface it with this, a growing number of mainstream scientists are actually publishing papers, and even a couple of books have been written now, suggesting that the universe may be what they call a massive consciousness computer. That's literally the language. They say we're living in a big computer, a consciousness computer. And rather than the numbers that usually make up the code of our Windows or our our Macintosh or our IBM laptop or whatever it is, rather than a number code, our consciousness computer uses a code based on emotion and belief. And if this is the case, then this field mirrors back. We're literally programming this field 24/7, and we have been for a long time, sometimes consciously and sometimes not. This principle has been understood for a long time. So back in the early 1980s, for example, it was the first war between Israel and Lebanon back in the early 80s. And there were people studying in the Midwest using the principles of TM. And I'm not saying that we have to use TM, but I'm saying in this experiment, these experiments, TM and what was called the Maharishi effect.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're talking about transcendental meditation for those
meditation. So what they did was they trained people to feel the feeling of peace in their hearts. Mm-hmm. Not think it in their minds, but feel peace in their hearts. The peace wasn't directed toward the Israelis or the Lebanese. It wasn't about peace for any one place or person or thing. It simply was peace. They took those people into the Middle East, and they planted them in the war-torn areas, and they did a series of experiments. What they found was during the window of time, when people were feeling these feelings of peace together, coordinated feelings, that all that could happen was peace. Mm-hmm. Terrorist activities stopped altogether, and crimes against people declined. Emergency hospital room visits declined. Traffic accidents declined. When they stopped what they were doing, all those statistics reversed. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, you know, maybe it was a fluke. Maybe it was the time of the month. Maybe it was a lunar cycle, or, you know, people go nuts on the full moon. Maybe that's what it was, or a holiday, and there were more police on the streets. So they did the experiments again and again and again, different times, and statistically they all came out the same. And what they found was when a relatively small number of people are feeling a focused, coherent emotion of peace. And this is what you're saying. It wasn't specific for the Israelis.
It wasn't that the Israelis go do this and that would bring peace.
Exactly. The key was, when they were feeling that feeling of peace, mm-hmm. peace was mirrored in the world around them. And the secret to this kind of application is that it happens from a place of non-judgment and non-ego. So there wasn't a good guy and a bad guy.
Exactly.
And there wasn't a winner and a loser, and there wasn't retribution for the good things or bad things that had obviously happened and do it in any war. It was simply making use of the fact, although it may not have been understood why mm-hmm. this happens. It was making use of the principle, the fact that this field will mirror back what it is that we give it to work with. If we want peace, we've got to give it peace to work with. This is why it probably doesn't do any good to get 3,000 people together in a war protest where everybody is angry about the war, because their anger, even though it's well-intentioned, their anger may actually be perpetuating the very condition that they'd like to change.
Because that's what they're sending out.
Because that's exactly what they're sending out. So that is an example to your question of generality of yes, when it comes to our lives, specificity is really important.
Sure.
Because if you say, and I've seen people, I mean, there are so many amazing case histories that cannot be proved scientifically, although that the correlations are so high between when people use these principles and when things happen in their lives. There's stories like a man that needed $75,000 to start a new business, and that was what he said. Any way he could get it, he wanted $75,000. And like 10 days later, both his parents are killed in an auto accident, and their insurance policy is worth $75,000, and that's what he ends up with. We're not saying that he caused the accident,
right.
But he had some guilt. He said, oh, I didn't mean that I wanted it at the expense of my loved ones. So it's good to be very specific, or people that create relationships. I want a beautiful, tall, strong, muscular blonde, and that blonde may come into your life with a consciousness and a personality that just drives you up the wall.
Right. So, I actually had that happen to a friend.
I've got a book of synchronicities and case histories about being specific, because this field appears to be very literal.
Sure.
And that's the key to the secret of this lost mode of prayer, because all the things we're talking about, this language, was actually recognized as a modality of prayer before it was edited from our text in the 4th century. And I talk about it in this book, and also in another book entitled Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. The key is to feel the feeling as if our prayer has already been answered.
Exactly.
To feel it without, from a place of non-judgment and a place of non-ego, and knowing that this field is very very literal in what it mirrors back to us. So this is why when we pray and say we want peace, dear God, please let there be peace in our world, or let there be healing in our loved ones, when we say that,
mm-hmm.
what we've actually implied, because we're asking for it to happen, we're implying that it's not there
exactly.
right now. And the field is literal, so the field will let it not be there right now.
Mm-hmm.
And keep letting it not be there. It's a subtle, very subtle shift in the language of feeling and emotion. If we can make that shift, rather than asking for something to happen, to coming from the place that it's already there, and giving thanks of gratitude and appreciation for the healing that already exists in our loved ones, or for the relationship, the nurturing, loving, compassionate relationship that's already in our lives, that is the simple shift that makes all the difference in the world, and that's the great secret that underlies our most cherished spiritual traditions.
So
that's what was edited right out of the Christian text in the 4th century, ironically.
I have no doubt.
Yeah, well, it was edited out with the 45 books, 20 were completely removed, another 25 were edited and condensed in mm-hmm. The council in the 4th century in the year 325 AD, and we know that because those books have been recovered in their entirety in the 20th century through the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Library and other Coptic library, other libraries.
Right.
So, you know, it all weaves together, and we've covered a lot of ground, and I've said a lot of words, and we've talked very quickly because I wanted to lay this foundation and cover this material before we go and find ourselves suddenly 5 minutes before the end of the program, and we haven't said those things. So
basically...
So now what do you want to do?
I'm excited because we're so aligned. Like I said, you have no idea. And I'm so excited that you're bringing the science side to what I've been teaching metaphysically for so long. And, you know, so basically what you're saying and what I know is that what we're coming down to is it's about how you feel when you get there, not all the little details of the process. Because the process
sure.
is a natural part of the outcome, but it's the outcome that we need to focus on.
Focus on the outcome as if it's already happened, rather
exactly.
than trying to engineer all of the steps to get to that outcome.
And don't ask.
and as an engineer, that was, for me, a very different way of looking at things. On the one hand, although it wasn't difficult, because once I understood the mechanism, it made tremendous sense. I said, of course, it must be that way.
Sure.
So if that's the value, I think, of understanding how this field works. If we choose to go this path, rather than accepting it on blind faith and always having a black box out there that we say, you know, we don't know how this works, but do this. When you understand the principle, then you understand, we all understand how we can uniquely apply it in our own lives. We don't have to ask other people because we understand it. So we know what kind of a prayer to say for our loved one in the intensive care unit when we're standing next to them, and for our loved one in the battlefield of Iraq halfway around the world, or for the checkbook that looks like it's going to be empty at the end of the month when the rent's due. We know that if we feel the lack and the emptiness of losing our loved ones or of having an empty checkbook, that this field is going to support us in that. And the opposite is true as well. If we feel the healing, even if
celebrate.
It's a miraculous healing,
sure.
Or the abundance in our lives, it comes that way. And I mean, I can tell you, we've given so many case histories in the book, both personal experience of mine as well as others from other authors. And I think those really help to anchor the concept and then illustrate how it works. You know, people, once they see a case history that worked for someone else, they say, you know, I had an experience kind of like that in my life, except mine was like this. And then they can relate their experience to the one that we're talking about and know perhaps why it worked. And then replicate it when they need to.
Yeah, and it's easy. It's just a kind of a by association. Oh, yeah, I get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we all learn. I'll speak for myself. I learned that way. One of the examples I give is, you know, when I go out and start my truck, I just want my truck to start. I can look at the manual, and it can explain, you know, when I turn the key, why the sparks in the pistons fire and why the pistons move and all that, but I don't care about any of that. When I turn the key, I just want my truck to start. Once it starts, if I want to go back and understand why it started, I can do that. But the bottom line is I just want it to go. It
doesn't matter.
Yeah, and this is, it kind of works this way with the things we're talking about. Some people, we all learn differently. Some people need to know the mechanism, and now it's there if we choose to understand that.
Well, how do little changes in our beliefs lead to big changes in our world? You know, we've talked kind of about the mechanism, but how do we apply that?
Well, the experiment that we just described, and by the way, that study was published, the study of peace in the Israeli-Lebanese War in the early 1980s. That study, a very famous study, it was called the International Peace Project in the Middle East. I'm just going to say this for the archives now so people can look it up.
Okay.
It was published in the Journal of Conflict Resolution, Volume 32, 1988, is when that study was published. And one of the things that happened, because it was a scientific study, and some of the scientists were statisticians, they were able to determine that a relatively small number of people can create a big change, in this case, in an entire geographic area. There weren't many people that were doing, you know, participating, but when they focused the power of their emotion and their belief and the coherent feelings of peace, that peace happened over a broad geographic area, and they were able to actually determine the formula for the number of people. How many people does it take in a given population to kickstart this kind of an effect?
What did they come up with?
To jumpstart the process, and it's a very small number. That I'll give you the formula, and then we'll talk about what that formula means. The formula is the square root of 1% of a given population. Square root of 1% of the population.
Wait, so that's not very many people.
No, so you take a population of people in a community or in a city or in a nation or on a planet. The same thing. You take the total number of people in your calculator, you punch in the 1%, so you find out what 1% of that number is, and then once you have the 1%, you hit the square root button, and they're very small numbers. So a city of 1 million people, for example, the square root of 1% of a million people is right around 100 people. And a world of 6 billion people that we live in right now, the square root of 1% is only about 8,000 people in a time of focused, coherent emotion. That's how many people it takes to kickstart this process. The more that participate, obviously, the more accelerated the effect is. But
as long as it's coherent and focused, and that was my point in these, you know, 2 and 3 million people things, they're not focused.
They're not focused, and there's a lot of ego involved.
That's it. Everybody's got an agenda.
Yeah, there is. There were some experiments that were done. We began talking about these studies publicly in 1998, and there were some national radio programs that picked it up and thought they'd have fun with it and do some experiments. And so they had large listening audiences, and they said, okay, everybody focus on blank. And some of the things were cruel. Some of the things were manipulative. And I think people were frightened when they found how much power they really had collectively, and they stopped doing those things.
Wow.
It's like children learning to play with a new toy or a new power. You've got to test the limits of what that power is. But I think what we're finding is that collectively we are empowered. And again, it's not to control or to manipulate. It's about we are empowered to participate
and
in
create
the outcome,
whatever we want.
The outcome of our time in history, and the catch is that we have to work together to do it. And to do that, we've got to recognize that we're a family, and we've got to recognize that, for right now anyway, this world is the only one we've got, and we've got to recognize that while we may not all see things the same way, we all have there's a common good that can come to all of us from preserving what we do have. And we learn that cooperation is much more beneficial than competition. And I think those are the great lessons of our time.
So, how does our military use this? How does the military use the Divine Matrix and battlefield situation?
Sure. Well, the field is so real. I'll tell you who was really ahead of their time were the Russians. The Russians have been using this back in the 60s when we didn't even acknowledge these things were happening. They were doing ESP experiments, you know, from astronauts in space.
Mm-hmm.
So for the listeners that have heard of things like remote viewing is essentially a waking dream. It's the phenomenon of a waking dream where an individual can be trained not to go to sleep in their dream, rather to drop off into a state of consciousness that we would call lucid dreaming, and then focus their consciousness on a point that is anywhere in the world, and the point can be a geographic, it can be a latitude longitude point, or it can be the intersection of two city blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is, from a room in a laboratory, in their mind, it is if they are at that place.
Sure.
And they can describe in great detail what it is that's there. The military used this in the first Gulf War in the early 90s.
Well, it's not hard to do.
No, well, we all have the ability to do it. The thing is that when we're not trained,
exactly,
we get lost in the lucid dream. What the training does is there's a facilitator that helps keep the dreamer focused and talks them through the protocols toward their goal. So you ask about the military, they were using this to find Scud missiles in the Iraqi desert in the first Gulf War so that we didn't have to risk the lives of our own people in the desert to find them. Once they narrowed down the location and they said, well, they're not here, but we're seeing them over here, then we could go in over here and we could take out those Scud missiles without risking the lives of a lot of troops. And all that was happening was a man or a woman was having a dream, and someone was walking them through the protocols in a room in Virginia or in a university setting in California. And you say, well, how could that happen? Well, obviously their consciousness is moving in a field, and that field is what this divine matrix, this quantum hologram, is all about.
Well, that brings us.
By the way, officially, the military stopped using those protocols in the mid-90s.
Officially,
and I just have to say that to be responsible. Officially, they don't do that. Unofficially, who knows? You know what's going on.
Yeah, right. Well, that brings us to a whole other subject of, it's really the same, but it's not, and how our ideas of here and there and past and future change based on this whole concept.
Sure. Well, what we know is that on the level of the energetic level that we're talking about, time and space, those ideas begin to break down. Here is there, as in the case of remote viewing. It's as if there is no distance between where the viewer is and his target, you know, on the battlefield in Iraq, halfway around the world, or when Noriega was disappeared, they were using remote viewers to try to find Noriega and bring him to justice. Or the Iranian hostages back in the late 1970s, you know, they were working with these things. So it's as if time and space doesn't exist. Here and there are one and the same. And what the experiments are showing is that past and present really doesn't exist in the same way. And this, some fascinating experiments have been done in the laboratory, and the implications in our lives are pretty staggering. But what they found is they can take quantum particles, the stuff that we're made of and that our world is made of. They can take those particles, the moment in time, and they can then project them into a future moment that maybe is 30 seconds later or maybe 5 minutes later, and they can make changes in the particle when it arrives 5 minutes later, and those changes actually change what happened to the particle before it even began the experiment. In other words, it's a little complex to do on...
So it's existing in both places simultaneously.
On the radio, well, what the experiments are showing is that changes made in the present actually affect what happened in the past. They're actually changing the past by changing the present. And so the question is...
Well, that's a whole new meaning of taking care of ancestral patterns.
the implications, I mean, we could do a whole program on this probably, that the implications are if we could make changes in the present and it changes what happened in the past...
Mm-hmm.
In the quantum stuff that our bodies are made of and our worlds are made of,
mm-hmm.
then does that mean that the changes that we make in our lives now are having an effect on what happened before we got to this point in our lives? In other words, if we can truly forgive, compassionately forgive, and heal our experiences in the moment, is it actually changing the events that led up to those experiences to begin with? Is there some kind of a feedback loop is what the research papers are speculating, that we're living a big time loop. It has all kinds of implications for, for things like obviously healing, peace, karma comes
mm-hmm.
into this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting implications. It's all based on hard science and what the scientists are finding in the laboratory and the experiments that are made on the stuff that we are made of. And the question is, if it happens in the laboratory to that stuff, is it happening beyond the laboratory in our world? And that's where this book goes,
to explore
that possibility.
Well, we've only got a couple minutes left, and...
I know, our time went fast tonight.
It does that.
Yeah.
I'd like for you to come back, will you?
I would be absolutely honored, whatever you did to make this happen, if you do that again, in another month, I'll meet you back here.
Deal. Well, we're working outside of time. That's what's going on. Hey, there's a couple of things I was really hoping to get to tonight that were really good points in your book. And I'm going to let you do with this what you want, but I'm going to throw them both out there, okay?
All right.
Because of the time thing. You talk about universal mirrors working in our lives, and but also about how the divine matrix is a force that's been with us forever, you know, responds to our beliefs related to God and heaven. And
sure.
You know, how does all this connect, Greg?
Well, in less than 60 seconds.
I know, I'm sorry.
The way scientists are describing this field, they say it has been here from the very beginning, the time they call the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
It's everywhere all the time, and it's an intelligent field that responds to human emotion. Except for the language, it sounds very similar to the way our ancient texts and even in the Christian and Hebraic traditions
yeah.
say that a God is a force that's been here from the very beginning, is everywhere all the time, and responds to our emotions, answers our prayers, and knows what we're thinking. So it may be, and the question is this field, this divine matrix, is this the stuff that God is made of? Is God the stuff that everything else comes from?
And if that's a fact, then we are that.
Then precisely, then we are part of rather than separate from. We mentioned earlier that there's a language. We speak the language of motion to the field, and that's half of the equation. And the second half that maybe we can do in another program is that the field answers us.
Sure.
It speaks back if we have the wisdom to recognize, and it does so in ways that are so precise. 2,000 years ago, the ancient Essenes recognized five categories of mirrors that we will all experience in our relationships, from very, very blatant to very subtle kinds of mirrors. Mirrors of telling us what our judgments are, mirrors telling us of the pieces of ourselves that we've lost or given away or had taken away by those who have power over us, and the mirrors that describe to us and show us what it is that we really, truly believe and cherish in our lives. So we all experience the mirrors. If
mm-hmm.
we have the wisdom to recognize what they're saying, we can heal the hurt that comes from those experiences And there's a bit of a cascade effect, because once one of the mirrors is healed in one way, it appears that other mirrors are healed and they respond as well, and that would be a whole topic unto itself.
Greg, this is phenomenal, and I wish we had a whole nother hour just so we could play. I really appreciate you being on, and I wish we had more time, but I'll take you up on that offer to come back, and
okay.
And we'll do it. So all of you listening out there that are saying you want more, it'll happen. Don't worry.
I want to thank you for being such a gracious host and for allowing me to speak quickly and cover a lot of material tonight. And
it's important. And your book, The Divine Matrix, is available at bookstores everywhere, I'm sure.
It's on Amazon, Borders, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold. You can get it on the website. You can get it anywhere. I just appreciate your vision for the program so we can have conversations like this on an evening like this.
Let's do some more of it. You know, the whole problem is that there's so much hype in the world. I find it offensive. So the whole point is let's have real conscious talk, and then we will have a greater reality. And once we all get on the same page.
Well, God bless you and all of our listeners.
Too,
I look forward to the next time.
Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
Too,
and
too,
to all of you out there that are listening, I just want to remind you that you can hear this show on the archives in a few days on www.worldpuja.org. I know there was a lot of information really fast, and we're going to do more of it, so stay tuned for next time. In the meantime, I'm wishing you joy in your heart, laughter in your days, and love in everything you do. Be in peace and have a beautiful evening. I'll see you here next week, same time. Good night.
Medicine Woman, the stunning first book of internationally acclaimed author and mystic Lynn Andrews. Now, a quarter of a century later, Lynn celebrates a whole new generation of readers with the 25th anniversary edition of this landmark publication. This book honors and celebrates the power of shamanism and the wisdom of Native American women around the world. In this just-released anniversary edition of Medicine Woman, Lynn adds for the very first time additional details of her apprenticeship with Medicine Woman Agnes Whistling Elk, and she shares new insights into her experiences in the Canadian wilderness. Share Lynn Andrews' Medicine Woman and the power of the universe today. Available at Amazon.com and other fine booksellers everywhere.